Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Aaron Ganney. He's the founder and CEO of Behavior LLC, creating digital therapeutics for behavioral health using the power of virtual reality. Ganney has been creating applications and experiences with technologies throughout his career in healthcare and financial services, including his most recent gig as Chief Technology Officer of Humana. Welcome, Aaron, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's great to be with you today.
So I'd like to hear a little bit more about the transition from financial services to Humana to a startup in the thick of it. How did you come to have this interest in healthcare technology?
Yeah, it was a desire to move back to Kentucky that led me into healthcare. So I had been in financial services, was working in Charlotte, North Carolina, with Wachovia, big super regional bank there. And my wife and I have family in Kentucky, and we looked around at great companies based in Kentucky and settled on Humana as a place that I'd like to go. And candidly, I didn't realize at the time how transformative it would be. But I quickly got that healthcare bug. You know, when you start working on things that are so meaningful in people's lives, it gets you really engaged really quickly. And there's no going back for most of us, you know. And once you see the impact that you can have for, you know, helping people over things that are so vitally important in their lives, nothing really comes close. So I joined Humana in 2006, had a wonderful 12-year run there. That's where I learned the ropes of healthcare, which is, of course, a complex industry with a lot of different stakeholders and a lot of different incentives at work and so on. But one thing that was clear and really struck me, particularly about Humana, but also for other folks that I met in the industry, is even though you have to deal with the regulatory complexities and the business complexities, most of the people in this industry are actually in it for the good that we can do in people's lives. And that's really motivating and drives, you know, everything that we do at Behavior. I had wanted my own business for many, many years, for most of my life, candidly. But I'd been fortunate to work with some great companies and great people. And so, you know, it's one of those things where you gotta push yourself out of your comfort zone. And in 2016, I founded Behavior to focus on improving access to care and improving health outcomes in behavioral health, with a particular emphasis or focus on the intersection of behavioral health conditions and chronic disease. And, you know, the importance of that intersection, that sort of meta comorbidity, I learned from my wonderful, smart colleagues at Humana. You know, it's a huge area of need, and we're already spending most of the money in the healthcare system, the vast majority of the money in the healthcare system, in fact, on folks who are living with chronic conditions. And then if you add in against that chronic condition, a set of unmanaged or undiagnosed behavioral health challenges, you know, life gets worse in a hurry, spending goes up 2 to 3x. It's just a huge area of impact in people's lives and a huge area to capture value. So that's what we set
and
up.
As we're speaking, sort of at the end of year one of the age of the coronavirus, we are seeing exponential growth in the area of need for behavioral health services. That's certainly a growing area and a growing area for remote services as well.
Absolutely. And I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg there, David. You know, we're all dealing with the coronavirus right now, but a lot of folks who study these things and sort of epidemiologists are predicting that the worst is yet to come in terms of the ripple effects on our mental and behavioral health. So we're delighted at Behavior to be in the right place at the right time. Obviously, we're not happy about the pandemic, but we're happy to be in a position to help people through it.
Mm-hmm. So behavioral health, chronic care, related issues perhaps in the wellness space, and then I just have to ask you, how did you come into looking at virtual reality as an avenue for addressing these issues?
Yeah, so I have been a lifelong technologist or geek, you might say. And so I've tracked these waves of technology innovation throughout my career. So I kept up with that, you know, the rise of the personal computing revolution and then mobility and cloud computing and health data interoperability and so on. And so I was aware of what was about to happen in 2016 with the consumerization, if you will, consumer grade virtual reality technologies coming to market. And I had an intuitive sense then, I didn't understand it then as well as we do now, that this was going to be really powerful and transformative in terms of how we experience and relate to technology. And at a simple level, when you think about the ability to completely engineer an experience that someone is going to have, that gives you an incredible platform on which to do diagnostics as well as therapeutics for something where, you know, really the sum total of our behavioral health is how we are affected by the experiences that we have throughout our lives, right? So if we can engineer experiences, we can take you in a direction of healing. And so we had that intuitive sense. It was primarily about settling on the right problem at the time. And I already sort of covered that briefly, right? This meta comorbidity of behavioral health. And then seeing this moment, the first moment in our history where we could take this medium of virtual reality, which would allow us to engineer experiences and connect it with a whole set of other exponential technologies that I mentioned, right? Cloud computing, analytics, interoperability finally coming to healthcare. It was, for the first time, an opportunity to really rethink how we deliver behavioral health care. And as I said, from diagnostics through therapeutics. So that, for me, as soon as that kind of crystallized, that was there was no going back. And we've been at it for about 4.5 years now.
Right. So do you see this as sort of a reinvention of diagnostics and treatment for these conditions? Or is it, I was going to say simply, I know it's not simple, but simply a porting of existing ideas to a new platform?
I'd say there's a mix of both, David. So, you know, healthcare is so big and complex and so important, right, that you don't completely transform an industry or even a sort of sector of an industry very quickly, right? And so we have to respect the dynamics of the industry from, you know, how patients interact with their clinicians and providers, the role of payers in the industry, the role of regulators, and so on. So that doesn't all go away. But what we think we can do with any digital intervention, and then I'll talk about some of the specific strengths of virtual reality, is extend from, you know, physical care into not just virtual, but really digital care, right? So if we think about force multipliers, there are not nearly enough qualified, trained, educated clinicians in the system to touch everybody that we need to help. And so, you know, and telehealth helps with access a little bit, but it doesn't create more clinicians, right? So what digital can do is extend care. If we make it part of a therapeutic toolkit, we can use digital as a first line of defense to reach more people at a you know, a level of cost that's an order of magnitude lower, help people with these digital interventions. While we're doing that, we collect a huge amount of data. And then, of course, we can connect them back to human clinicians as needed. And we can sort of triage to the right level of human clinician, right? Do you need a coach? Do you need a counselor, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, something else, right? So triage up to a top of licensed clinician. So it's really a blend. Some of what we're doing is brand new. Other parts of it are integrating with the existing system to create efficiencies and help us reach more people, you know, more cost effectively.
So when you talk about the cost to the system, and you're talking about a new category of service or product, so to speak, the question comes up, is this reimbursable? Is what you're building something that comes within the range of digital therapeutics that are approved by FDA and are covered by payers in the private sector and in the public sector? Because otherwise, yes, this may reduce, quote unquote, the cost to the system overall, but it may create a need for a different sort of payment structure, whether it's out of pocket for an individual or for an employer health plan, for example.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I've got a certain amount of payer DNA, right? Given my years at Humana and, you know, other folks, colleagues in the industry and so on. And so we actually have a slightly more nuanced view about the relationship of digital therapeutics that, you know, have been evaluated by the FDA and cleared by the FDA, and the relevance of that to whether or not something will get paid for. So they're not the same thing. You know, what payers really need are things that improve the health of their members and save them money. And generally, the big lever on saving money is improving health, therefore reducing overall utilization of healthcare services, right? And, you know, getting rid of the need for additional services because you're improving health. That is what payers wake up and think about virtually every day.
Sure.
What they don't think about necessarily every day is, what new thing just got cleared by the FDA that I can pay for? That's kind of two different dimensions, right? So I do believe there's a role for FDA cleared digital therapeutics where you need and want the ability to make claims about, you know, diagnosing or treating or curing disease. I think that what guides you on whether you want an FDA cleared therapeutic or you want an evidence-based proven general wellness program or set of services is not driven by desire to get paid. I think you can get paid both ways. I think that the FDA pathways really have to do more with what claims you make in the market, what level of clinical oversight and engagement are appropriate for a program. So just to oversimplify slightly, a payer might say, hey, David, we know you're struggling with this condition, let's say chronic pain. We want to enroll you in a wellness program that's going to teach you additional skills to deal with that pain, understand what's happening in your brain and body, get you over your fear of movement and get you moving, for example. Well, that may not need direct oversight by a clinician to have beneficial effect for you. There may be other therapeutics where we need a clinician right there with you. And so that's how we think about the sort of distinction between what could be a wellness product and be very effective in the market versus something that you'd want to take through FDA, you know, approval or clearance pathways.
Sure. So I recognize there could be some things that you're doing that would be on your roadmap that wouldn't require an FDA approval, but and others that would.
Right.
I guess I'm wondering whether some sort of stamp of approval, though, would make it easier to get through the payer approval and adoption process versus going through the process, you know, I mean, you still have to go through a process with each payer, but maybe it's easier if you walk in with something that's FDA approved.
Yeah, I get your point, and I think there's validity there. It's complicated. I mean, I've had very senior people at payers. I won't name the payers. Say, you know, many digital companies will pursue FDA clearances and approvals, and most shouldn't. And their point being, it's a huge investment of time and energy and capital, when in fact it's really not necessary for market access in many cases. So again, there's room for both. I think what's healthier, and in our business, we're bringing to market both general wellness products and digital therapeutics, right? So there are these other dimensions of what are the indications for use? What's the labeling? You know, what level of clinical oversight is required? What level of risk versus sort of safety is involved? We think those are the right dimensions. Getting paid is really about focusing on how you're helping that individual person improve their health and how you can save money for the system, which is, you know, desperately needed given how out of control healthcare spending is here in the U.S.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Aaron Ganney, CEO of Behavior. So, Aaron, you've spoken a little bit about some of the areas of interest for you, either as a digital therapeutic or as a wellness tool. We've talked about chronic conditions. We've talked about behavioral health. You've mentioned pain management. And I'm wondering if you could take us through the process of working out a particular line of service or a particular tool that gets built on your platform. Do the three things I just mentioned, does that sort of describe the universe that you're focused on right now? Or are there other kinds of conditions or areas of interest to you right now, and sort of how have you gone about focusing on these particular areas?
Everything we do is within the realm of behavioral health care, but we don't tackle everything in behavioral health. What we are specifically focused on is fear and anxiety related disorders. And the reason that is our sweet spot has to do with the unique neurological power of virtual reality. VR gets processed by our brains as a multi-sensory experience through the visual thalamus and visual and auditory cortices. And it's what neuroscientists call a bottom-up experience. And it routes actually through the older parts of our brain first. So signals straight to the amygdala, deciding, am I under threat? Do I need to respond to this threat? And so on. And then a few milliseconds later, that information that we've processed from a sensory perspective is passed to the prefrontal cortex, where we decide what's really happening. That's a little bit of a neurological way to describe what people experience when they get in VR, which is it feels real, right? So your brain sort of can't differentiate between your normal actual experience and what we're exposing you to in VR. And what can we do with that? Well, we can deliberately put you in situations that calm you down. So get you out of a chronic activation of your stress response. To be a little bit more clinical about it, we're moving you from sympathetic nervous system activation to parasympathetic. So this is deactivate the chronic stress response. Then we deal with combating anxiety, which is sort of worry about non-present threats, right? Racing thoughts, rumination, worry about the future. We can combat that with building mindfulness practice and emotion regulation skills. And the third layer is we can deliberately expose you to scenarios or situations that are problematic for you, that trigger a fear response or a threat response. Well, why would we want to do that? That's called exposure. And then when you live through that exposure, your brain sort of lays down some new neural traces that say, you know what, I lived through that. I can downgrade the emotional intensity and salience of that threat. So that is called exposure and extinction. That's normally done through talk therapy. Sometimes it's done out in the real world. That's called in vivo exposure therapy, but that's very time consuming and expensive and maybe even dangerous. VR is this beautiful spot in between, where we can engineer an experience designed to expose you to some problematic stimuli that is stress or, you know, fear triggering for you, and then through the process of extinction, downgrade that threat. So we're literally at a neurological level through neuroplasticity, helping people work through the things that put them into this chronic state of stress activation. Now, the intersection with chronic disease is that when you are in that state of chronic stress activation, that can lead to a ripple effect through your body of chronic inflammation. It can make other chronic conditions much harder to manage. So it'll do everything from increasing, you know, blood pressure and hypertension, worsening that, makes blood sugar harder to control, just sort of spirals and ripples through the body. So by helping those folks who are struggling with stress, anxiety, fear, pain, substance and opioid use disorders, and so on, we can have the beneficial effect, not just on their mental health, but on their physical health and their maintenance of chronic conditions as well.
As I hear you talking about this, it's clear that you're focusing, at least in part, on certain applications here, where the tools you're talking about are really uniquely situated to deliver a new kind of service or to deliver it in a cost-effective way. And I guess as you demonstrate that, I imagine you'll be able to find greater adoption. Are there other sort of hurdles that you see in your path to greater adoption of this tool? I mean, I assume this is sort of early days for virtual reality and healthcare in general.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting point. So there have been in research settings and sort of university settings, a couple of decades of research demonstrating the powerful effects of this medium on a range of conditions related to, as I said, the sort of fear and anxiety related disorders, right? So dealing with chronic stress, with specific phobias, with social anxiety, generalized anxiety, PTSD, and so on. So there's actually a lot of evidence built up over many, many years demonstrating that this is a powerful medium for those specific applications. what we're in the stage of now is our company behavior and some others. We've got some great, you know, fellow travelers and competitive companies that are commercializing what we've learned in those research settings and turning them into products that are not only effective, but they're cost effective, they're scalable, they're easy enough for clinicians to use and for individual consumers to use in their homes, and then connecting them to the cloud, collecting all that data and so on. So the barriers to adoption are primarily about proving not just clinical effect, but you know, health economic outcomes, right? That this is a good investment of the system's resources to improve health and drive savings. That will happen. It's not easy, and it certainly takes time and capital, but I'm quite confident that's going to happen, not just for our company, but frankly, for several companies in the space. I mean, this is, it's not that exotic or cutting edge, the idea of using this medium in this way. Most of what we're challenged with right now is bringing up the level of awareness around the industry and demonstrating, you know, things move slowly in healthcare for a reason. We have to be a little conservative about these things, make sure we do no harm, make sure we're driving the right outcomes and savings. And that just takes a lot of time and effort and money, but it's getting there. And so we actually, while we compete, we cheer on our competitors as well, because it's good for all of us, for more and more people every day to realize, you know, this is a new approach. This is a different medium that shouldn't be applied to everything, but when it's applied to the right things, it can have a really, really powerful effect. And just to give you a sense of some of the products that we bring to market today, we have our program for chronic pain that I mentioned already. It's based on pain neuroscience education, sort of educating you about the nature of pain in your body and how to deal with it. We then get you over your fear of movement, which is a big thing with many folks with chronic pain. That's called kinesophobia. And then get you moving. So in VR, we can integrate the cognitive, the emotional, and the physical in a way that you really can't do with any other medium. We also have programs for tackling chronic stress generally. Our program Centered VR, we co-developed with Johns Hopkins. We have a program called Nurture VR, which is all about supporting maternal mental health during the third trimester and fourth trimesters of pregnancy for new mothers who are under all sorts of stresses, right? From, you know, physical challenges and hormonal shifts and general stress in their lives. And it's a big area of need. And then we're also working on a social anxiety, what will ultimately be a digital therapeutic. So lots more to come and a lot happening across the industry, not just with our company, but with several competitive companies.
Oh, this is fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your describing what you're looking at and sort of what's out there and what's out there in the future. To wrap things up, I'd really like to ask you about the future. If you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what's one thing in healthcare that you'd hope or expect to find has changed drastically?
Well, broadly, I think what needs to change, and I expect will change, is the degree to which we view digital interventions and platforms as a first line of defense in improving health broadly, but especially mental or behavioral health. And so it will move beyond digitization of like standard protocols, like let's take a CBT exercise and put it on a smartphone, which is a good thing, right? All these sort of steps to date, the ones that are effective are good. But where we can go, we know generally that digital environments, platforms are most powerful when they connect people with each other, right? And with resources that are relevant and helpful. And that's how we see this playing out is people from the comfort of their homes or wherever they want to engage will get access to digital resources that are sort of self-service, right? That are, you know, hyper efficient, you know, because digital things can be expensive to create, but they're almost free to distribute. And then they'll also find through those digital networks other human beings who can be helpful, right? And that could mean peer-to-peer. Maybe you and I have gone through a similar health journey and we want to be there and support each other. Or maybe you're well ahead of me on that journey and you want to volunteer as a lay person who's going to help me on my journey. Or we both want to connect, you know, up that stack of clinicians that I mentioned, right up to some top of licensed clinician. So the view of the future we have is people connecting with each other and with a set of digital resources on these connected digital platforms. Today, digital is still thought of as sort of a generally an add-on to the bricks and mortar healthcare system. You know, how do we make it easy to get an appointment or do a telemedicine visit or look up a medical record or something like that? Digital will become part of the delivery system and probably the part that gets used the most if we do this right. That will be true broadly. We happen to think virtual reality, because of the way that it can sort of transport you to a virtual place or space, has particular promise in that regard. And that's what we think is in our future as well.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Again, thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed chatting with you today.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.